reason Janus's findings are still being discussed is that the symptoms of the bank were not isolated in the federal government. They can be found in virtually every organization from the United Nations down to the family. I believe that this perspective can give us an understanding of why certain types of decisions are made in the church. The utility of the groupthink hypothesis is that it helps explain why decisions, which in retrospect seem inane and undesired by the individual participants, are made by a group composed of the same individuals. All right, an overview of groupthink. I would like to begin by presenting an overview of groupthink. There are several different formulations or variations on the theory. What I am presenting today is based very closely on the early work of Janus and the modifications of Moorhead, although influenced heavily by my own interpretations. I will be discussing, number one, the antecedent conditions prior to groupthink, the symptoms of groupthink by which it can be diagnosed, the decision-making defects that occur, the results of the phenomenon of groupthink, and how we can avoid groupthink. Number one, antecedent conditions. There are certain circumstances known as antecedent conditions which are necessary for groupthink to occur. The first of these is high cohesiveness. A highly cohesive group is often a good thing. It is one in which the members care for each other, tend to agree on many things, and share a common set of values and sense of purpose. The second condition, insulation of the group from outside input, is almost never a desirable circumstance. Much like a sequestered jury, some groups intentionally or unintentionally isolate themselves from outside information and opinions. The third condition, a dominant leader, can be either desirable or undesirable, depending on the type of task and circumstances surrounding a decision. A la the platoon leader, you want one. Maybe in some church councils, not so much. However, these three conditions, high cohesiveness, insulation from outside input, and a dominant leader, taken together, form an ideal setting for groupthink to take place. Two, concurrence-seeking tendency. Ah, there we go. These conditions yield a group which values concurrence and unanimity above all else. This is not necessarily bad. Anyone who has been in or observed a fractious group knows how much energy and time can be wasted through petty bickering, posturing, and gamesmanship. However, valuing concurrence too highly can give rise to poor decision-making. How can we tell when this is likely to occur? Janus gives us 8 symptoms of a group susceptible to groupthink. While not each of these symptoms need be present for groupthink to take place, they tend to occur together. The illusion of invulnerability is the feeling of group members that they are somehow insulated from the consequences of their decisions. This is the part that's similar to the mob mentality. This is not to say the group members don't feel that they can make bad decisions. It just means they feel safe from any repercussions from those decisions. Time and time again, staff at the White House and in many other bureaucracies have acted with impunity, never seeming to fear the consequences of their actions. The illusion of morality keeps group members from questioning themselves and the processes they are involved with. Oliver North is the embodiment of this. He and the others involved in the whole Arms-Contra fiasco were such believers in their cause, they became blinded to any ethical dilemmas they encountered. The desire to maintain cohesiveness above all else leads to an illusion of unanimity. That is to say, in the absence of overt opposition to ideas or decisions, group members assume that there is unanimous agreement, or at least unanimous agreement without their own dissent. Self-censorship is another inevitable result of the pressure for cohesiveness. After being stared down in a board meeting or dressed down in front of an audience once, most people learn that silence may be the best policy. Anybody ever experienced that in church meetings? Relief society? Okay. Dysfunctional groups, it doesn't take us long to learn, does it? Dysfunctional groups, well, some are slow learners, I know. But I'm not just looking at you. I'm sorry. I'll scan the audience. I always have my MBA students scan the audience. There we go. Dysfunctional groups often have a majority of members who feel uncomfortable voicing their opinions. Several of the members of the policy-making group involved in the Bay of Pigs invasion later indicated they had severe misgivings, yet kept them to themselves out of a desire not to be the lone dissenter. Peer pressure for conformity helps to keep troublesome questions and information out of the discussion. Dictators such as Saddam Hussein tend to surround themselves with pliant lackeys. Those who bring up disagreements are often either put in their place or soon find themselves out of decision-making circles, or worse. Stereotyping opponents makes opposition easy to dismiss. It helped the Nixon White House to avoid looking introspectively at its actions. Leftist agitators, whether misguided or intentionally, were perceived to be trying to tear down the very fabric of the nation. Democrat politicians were viewed as the dupes of these groups, so blinded by the rhetoric that they were unable to sense the threat. Rationalization helps to dispel any doubts the group may have about the actions it is taking. I am sure H.R. Haldeman and company helped reassure one another that what they were doing, no matter how specious, was just for the good of the country. The presence of mind guards can help to foster this illusion. Valuable data and opinion may fail to reach the group because individuals within the group attempt to isolate it from uncomfortable facts and opinions. This is the role of the Inquisition played for the Church in the Middle Ages. Political controllers often play this role today. While the symptoms of groupthink are...
You've indicated the difficulties, and I recognize them all in what happened in our particular ward, but there isn't any clean way of breaking up that solid block. I tried a couple of methods to break up the solid block, and I was very unsuccessful.
Okay, so the comment by Leonard Wald is that to try and avoid this kind of surface unanimity or cohesion, it's tough to do, and to bring up outside ideas?
Right, you bring up outside ideas, and they are not, you need a very solid block of objection. In some cases, they merely just say, oh, like, this is silliness, why should we even bother to wait?
Well, people become very threatened, and especially when you have a worldview that's cohesive and a comfortable place to be, one lone dissenting voice can threaten you to your very core. And I don't want to digress too much, but I remember the one time I've ever talked to a church leader. I mean, I went a year without seeing my mission president. I've never talked to church leader. I've never unburdened my problems. And one time I said, I'm going to go into my bishop. We happen to have a master's in anthropology. He's a pretty cool, thoughtful guy, I thought. And you know, I said, well, these are some of the problems I'm having with the doctrine or whatever. He avoided me forever. And he later told my wife I was too threatened by him. I couldn't. So... even at that level, the bishop felt threatened when I voiced any alternate, even concerns.
You've got that list out there. How do you break up?
Well, I'll give you some points, but I think it has to start at the top. Hold on a while. I do have some suggestions, but it's tough to do, and I don't think you can do it at a local level.
Okay.
All right. Go ahead, Clint. Symptoms of groupthink are undesirable in many circumstances in and of themselves. The real problems occur when they lead to effective decision-making. A limited search for information, fortunately, I'll go ahead and keep reading. Unfortunately, it plagues many groups. Either through self or just as likely because of a desire to have decisions flow smoothly, research is often inadequate. For one thing, groups may not explore all potential or likely alternatives once the group senses there is a preferred alternative. Another problem is the failure to identify all the risks involved in a preferred decision. This is often observed in the early days of a new administration. I'm thinking of U.S. administration. Eager advisors push through an initiative only to see it crash and burn due to political considerations. Recent U.S. military entanglements may be examples of decisions made in spite of tremendous risk because of a faith in the U.S. rather than careful analysis. Many warning signals were apparently ignored in Bosnia, Somalia, etc. An incomplete analysis of alternatives can narrow the potential courses of action too narrowly. Isolation from experts or others from outside the group can mean that some options are not even considered. For example, the option for handling the shelling problem in Bosnia may have been seen as either continuing to issue warnings or bombing the artillery emplacements. A new ally who was not consulted, Russia, came up with a new face-saving option which had some effect. Once the group members have a sense the group is leaning one way, alternatives which may have many attractive features may not be reconsidered. A corollary problem is an incomplete survey of objectives. In other words, groups may fail to examine some of their most basic assumptions. An example may be found in the funding approach the NIH takes in dealing with cancer, AIDS, and other diseases. Obviously, most people would agree that finding a cure for disease is a noble goal. Does that consume 100% of the funding efforts, or should some funds be allocated to finding ways to improve the lives and mitigate the suffering of those who have little prospect of cure? In other words, we talk about decision premises. Everything flows, and in cohesive groups, you never seem to question those premises. Another problem observed in these overly cohesive groups is the rejection of expert opinions. Hitler and his reigning clique were notorious for ignoring the expert advice of the German general staff, which was composed of a group of highly competent and knowledgeable individuals. Finally, few if any contingency plans are drawn up in case conditions change or more information is obtained. Groups plow ahead with decisions, even when it seems to make no sense to do so, called escalation of commitment. The decision to go ahead with the raid on the Branch Davidian compound, even after it was learned that they were tipped off, seems to be a good example of a lack of contingency planning. Poor quality decisions are the most obvious results of a group operating under groupthink conditions. Illegal or immoral actions, unwanted product introductions, scapegoating, dangerous games, etc., commonly occur even when they are seen, even when they seem silly in retrospect. As a father, soon to be teenager, the influence. Well, actually, I have. Got to edit this part. I got one that's 14 and one that just started college. One that started high school and one that started college. The influence of peer pressure on group decision making scares me, but groupthink can affect group performance in other ways. For example, it may cause poor relations with other groups, a failure to do quality work, and diminished satisfaction among its members. The group will probably waste scarce resources and lose opportunities which otherwise would have been perceived and seized. Which leads us to the question. Go ahead, Clint. Is it possible for highly cohesive groups to avoid groupthink? The answer is yes, probably at the cost of some cohesiveness. The first thing that can be done is to promote open inquiry. Group members need to be encouraged to voice all of their ideas and outside information to bear on the problems. One useful device is the use of a devil's advocate. In this case, the individual or individuals would be assigned to be critical of a preferred alternative and be responsible for pointing out any potential problems with it. I find while this is done efficiently and to a certain degree comfortably in academic settings, it is very uncomfortable, or it is a very uncomfortable process in most group settings, especially within church, where criticism is a bad word. In academia, those of you who've been to graduate school, criticism is a good thing. It's a positive. At least the word has a positive connotation. Another useful device is to use subgroups to study a problem independently and report to the larger group without being privy to either the leaders or other group members' analysis or preferences. It is more likely for individuals to feel comfortable expressing opinions and freely exploring ideas in a smaller group. One of the most important principles is to use non-directive leadership styles. There is no greater impediment to effective debate than for a powerful leader to indicate preferences. Partly in response to some of Janice's findings, President Kennedy at times absented himself from cabinet meetings to make sure that he wasn't stifling debate by virtue of indicating his preliminary preferences. The best way to make sure that decisions are at least reasonable given the circumstances is to invite outside experts to the group to offer both independent analysis and opinion, as well as to evaluate alternatives under consideration. This is a role which is well compensated in the management consulting business. I think, Glenn, isn't it?
Okay.
All right. Often, consultants are paid not for their knowledge alone, much of which may already be available inside the organization, but rather for their judgment, which is untainted by organizational membership and loyalty to the hierarchy. This is a great lesson that I learned working for Glenn's old company. I was doing an internship there, and I remember I said, Glenn, the level of analysis here is lousy. I can't believe they're charging all this money. And then I found out later on that really what they want to do is somebody outside to tell them what they knew they had to do in the first place. It's a little more palatable from a political point of view. And apparently a lot of management consulting is just that. You pay someone to tell you what you wanted to do in the first place. It's legitimate. A final safety device is to hold second-chance meetings in which members are specifically charged with revisiting assumptions and any reservations about a given decision, as well as invited to return to any alternatives which have been rejected but which still may hold some merit. Okay, ready? While I strongly suspect that the groupthink phenomenon influences decision-making at all levels within the church, these conclusions have to be based primarily on conjecture. Unlike Janice, who had access to meetings within the Kennedy administration, I am privy to very little decision-making within the church, even at the local level over the last few years. However, my experiences have convinced me that this phenomenon occurs frequently, or at least that the potential exists broadly. Clearly, the antecedent conditions exist today and have existed at all levels. Conversion to Mormonism has historically meant much more than faith, repentance, and baptism. It means immersion in a highly cohesive culture in which we are encouraged to regard other Mormons as brothers and sisters, non-members as Gentiles. The we, they, and stakes of Zion / wicked world dichotomies are stressed. We are encouraged to meet together often for religious communion, socially, in service situations to plan and solve problems. This cohesiveness is strengthened in the ruling councils. Members of Elders Quorum and Relief Society presidencies, high councils, and higher-ranking groups develop even stronger bonds with their fellow members. While in some ways the cohesiveness throughout Mormondom cannot be as strong as it was, say, in the Pioneer era, in many ways, that is just as strong today within many subpopulations. By the same token, Mormonism has always had an isolationist bias. The church was seen as a refuge which would provide for all of the needs of its members. By learning not to, quote, trust on the arm of flesh, unquote, we learn not to trust ideas and information from outside sources. I find it interesting that even our hymnal is becoming more uniquely Mormon, with less Protestant influence. The leadership of the church has striven over the years not to give the impression that outside influence has had an impact on internal decisions. Many feel that this is why the first and second manifestos and the revelations on blacks and the priesthood were so tardy in coming. But I must also observe that the recent push in Relief Society to do service and make a difference in our communities is a promising trend towards less isolation. Finally, we as a people are obsessed with hierarchy. We not only envision the kingdom of God on earth as a theocratic hierarchy, but imagine both the afterlife and pre-existence that way. Okay, heaven's going to be hierarchical as well. One intelligence, read Purim, is always greater than another. It is hardly surprising that we fall into hero worship. We rise when a authority enters a room, are solicitous of a bishop's desires, and reverence regional and general authorities. Perhaps the most dominant leaders exist in the mission field, where mission presidents have virtual dictatorial control over their charges. Dominant leaders pervade Mormonism. But the presence of these antecedent conditions alone is not enough to conclude that groupthink is common within the church. The symptoms of groupthink must also be present for us to come to this conclusion. I am convinced that we often lapse into an illusion of invulnerability. I read a Sunstone article on Wilford Woodruff's millennial obsession. It reminded me that throughout our history, we have believed that the end is near, when the problems of the world will be done away and the true church will triumph. I believe that the manifesto was such a shocking event, not just because it ended a practice integral to our theology, but mainly because it shattered the illusion of power and invulnerability that was fostered among the membership. Whether illusory or not, there is clearly a climate of moral superiority in the church generally and among its hierarchy specifically. I believe that assertion with supporting examples. I believe that the illusion of unanimity has become even more deep-seated than ever. As Michael Quinn has shown us, debate and open discussion used to be much more common in the ruling church councils. At the ward level, common consent has evolved into an unwitting parody of communist elections. So, by the way, I always have to say this. I was one of the few church authorities I know was turned down by common consent. I was voted out as branch president. Well, I was failed to be confirmed as a branch president in the mission field until they called them all to repentance. But it was a long story. It had nothing to do with me. They didn't know me, but they didn't want somebody new. Self-censorship is a common experience for most of us. Imagine the pioneer days when state, financial systems, legal systems, etc. were all intertwined, and ill-spoken words could affect your status in each. My strongest experience with self-censorship came in the mission field. Full-time missionaries soon learned that keeping quiet is often the best policy in an isolated, intensive subculture. Inseparable from self-censorship is peer pressure to conform. We are brought up that way. We are indoctrinated to give Sunday school answers, bear testimony, and pray according to outline, imitate the dress of current general authorities and their wives, approve all decisions regardless of personal feelings. Which reminds me, just imagine going up and saying the Book of Mormon is true on testimony meeting. I still remember the incredible pressure in the mission field to support occasionally inane goals and policies. And by the way, Albert was in the mission field. He was actually an assistant to the president. I was only in that mission for about 5 months before I got kicked out. But no, I got transferred. I did know him then. He was a lot less serious then than he is now. I don't know. Yet even at times in my life when I haven't been conscious of the pressure, it was still there. I loved my BYU experience as much as I did precisely because I was so conformist. Those who didn't conform to the pressure had a very different experience. One of the things which bothers me the most in the context of my church membership is the extent to which we stereotype real and perceived opponents to the church. Just participating in Sunstone labels one to the extent that in some circles almost all ideas or opinions are discounted. Even though we no longer publicly label the Catholic Church the great and abominable whore of the earth, does not mean that we are any less prejudicial in our views of other churches' actions and motivations. Not that I wish to imply that this behavior is unique to the Mormon Church. All one has to do is turn on a religious broadcast any time of the day to encounter almost unbelievable stereotyping of disbelievers or believers from other religious traditions. Rationalization of information which conflicts with official or unofficial dogma pervades our history. One form it takes is the attempts to impugn the moral character or motivation of professional historians or other scholars who apply modern scholarship in examining Mormon phenomena. Of course, rationalization doesn't need to take place as often as it might in our church experience because of the presence of mind guards who seek to insulate us from uncomfortable information entirely. It seems to me that this may be the main objective of the whole correlation movement, but I observe it in most Sunday school classes. Teachers are unwilling to entertain open discussion, and when they are, often run into class members who are more than willing to stop us before we, quote, delve into the mysteries. Okay, possible examples of decisions influenced by groupthink. As I stated earlier, I feel that groupthink has influenced decision-making at all levels in the church since its earliest days. While it may be presumptuous of outsiders to diagnose the inner workings of groups, I feel that three examples may help to illustrate at least the potential for the groupthink phenomenon to take over and lead to undesirable or even disastrous outcomes. The first is perhaps the most regrettable chapter in what, for the most part, is a faith and pride-inspiring history of the colonization of the Intermountain West by our Mormon forebears. Mount Meadows massacre was a tragedy not only because of what happened to the unfortunate victims, but also because of who the perpetrators were. Other more recent examples include the so-called purge of intellectuals, feminists, etc., and church involvement in political issues outside of Utah. All right, the Mount Meadows massacre. For those of you unfamiliar with the incident, I will offer a brief overview. In early August of 1857, a group of settlers came through Salt Lake City. It was composed mainly of a wealthy Arkansas and a more rowdy group from Missouri. This was a time of high tension in Deseret. Word had recently come that Buchanan's army was marching to Salt Lake. There were continuing difficulties with the native Indian tribes. It was also a time of high religious fervor, the so-called Reformation. Talks were being given on the principle of blood atonement and the need for the corporal punishment of sinners. Due to the fate of the Donner Party the previous winter, the settlers decided to take a southern route to California. This meant that they would spend several weeks on their journey through Deseret. Apparently, the Saints decided not to trust the group, even to supply necessities. This was most likely because some of the Missourians in the group boasted that they had participated in the persecution of the Saints in Missouri. It appears that several of the less disciplined members of the group also engaged in some petty thievery of foodstuffs, adding to the animosity. You signaling me, or? No. Oh. Either during or after a priesthood council in Cedar City on September 6th, a decision was made to either incite the local Indians or conspire with them to exterminate all or part of the group of settlers. Who spoke last night? Levi talked about it. He gave some details. I'm not so sure we know exactly as definitively as he led us to believe last night what happened there. But in any event, we do know there was some ambiguity, but definitely church members participated. This decision was arrived at over time and only after interpreting some church leader statements and others' silence as approval for any punishment to be visited upon them. Ultimately, a group of Mormons not only encouraged an attack, but became active participants in the massacre of men, women, and children, regardless of what was said last night. Okay, I believe that all of the antecedent conditions for groupthink were present in southern Utah in 1857. To begin with, the Saints in southern Utah were a cohesive group. They were bound by religion, by a shared difficult pioneer experience, and by previously experienced persecution by Missourians and perceived threats from Indians. Beside the typical close social and economic ties, many members of the group may have belonged to the Danites. Like all Mormons, they were isolated geographically and socially from outsiders. They were even more economically isolated than those living in northern Utah. It is unlikely many ideas or objective opinion found its way into their conversation or periodicals. It is clear that the participants were dominated by a hierarchical structure beginning with Brigham Young and proceeding to the stake president, Isaac C. Haight. I also believe the symptoms of groupthink were present. It is hard to judge the extent to which the co-conspirators felt invulnerable, but the Saints in those days had a definite millennial viewpoint and a faith that God would ultimately come to their aid if they remained faithful. They certainly felt a sense of superior morality. The ultimate fall guy, John D. Lee, was an adopted son of Brigham himself. It is hard to ascertain if there was an illusion of unanimity. For one thing, there was opposition voiced in the priesthood council in Cedar City, and we don't know the perceptions of all of the actual participants. The same holds true for the amount of self-censorship. However, the extant records seem to show that relatively few objections were raised after the council, given the terrible nature of the scheme. We can only imagine the strength of the peer pressure to conform, or for conformity, in a climate of blood atonement, reformation, and isolated colonization. There we go. Historical treatments would indicate that apostates, a word which was much more broadly defined in those days, were persecuted vigorously. I have doubts that the members of the attack party were stereotyped. Given some of the taunting they were said to have undertaken in, perhaps some of the stereotyping was deserved. Rationalization occurs at the individual level. After reading John D. Lee's account, one comes away convinced that he rationalized to a great extent to be able to go forward with the act. It is more difficult to tell who may have played the role of mind guard. I truly believe that the people who participated in this horrible act were basically good people. I also believe that many of the direct participants, and certainly the hierarchy in Salt Lake City, did not wish it to happen. But a group phenomenon took hold, which overwhelmed individual consciences and rational thought. It is a terrible example of how even good people can be caught up in group dynamics during stressful times, which lead them to commit bad acts which they never would have dreamed of doing individually. And I believe that firmly. What I am referring to when I say the purge, what am I referring to? It was, most of you probably know what I'm referring to, but it was the systematic interviewing, interrogating, of members several years ago who had known to publicly espouse nonconformist or uncomfortable ideas. These ideas mainly seemed to deal with perceived or real criticism of the church hierarchy, church history, some uncomfortable church doctrines, feminism, and homosexuality. As a context, perhaps we should recall some of the things that were happening during this time. But new Mormon history was actually quite mature by the 90s and causing a lot of discomfort. The Correlation faction, among the brethren, was still in its ascendancy and asserting pressure to continue putting the priesthood in charge. And, God forbid, BYU was overrun with free-thinking professors, independent publications, and some visible nonconformist students. And we know that the general authorities were paying a lot of attention to this at the time, a lot of concern over what was happening at BYU. Worldwide, there was a trend in almost all religions to return to a fundamental certitude in a world facing rapid social, economic, political, cultural, and technological change. I'll just add here, if you think about it, the Catholic Church, just not only when John Paul came in, but in the 90s became much more, I think, fundamentalist and black and white in their doctrine. The Taliban arose, dichotomous, rigid, whatever. But almost all world religions, including those in the United States, tended to become more fundamentalist as a haven from this changing world. I'm probably on shaky ground in trying to infer that there was a single decision which has led to some of the more notorious excommunications, interviews, and resignations which have taken place. Yet I am convinced that many of these and associated actions, which appear to violate not only general ethical and moral principles, but even written church policies, came about as a result of decisions made at the highest levels in the church. The antecedent conditions are all there. Their brethren are clearly a cohesive group. From their public announcements, it is clear that they both love and respect one another to a degree almost unprecedented among a group of individuals whose collective accomplishments and credentials are so truly outstanding. I've heard that there is even an underground tunnel leading from the Eagle Gate Apartments to the Temple and Church Office Building. That's so they don't have to mingle with everyone else, I guess. President Benson taught that we only need to look to the prophet for spiritual, social, political, and other guidance. That was before he was prophet, but it appears that one of the emerging roles for the Correlation Department is to filter information and items going before the brethren. An interesting thing to ponder when one considers that the department is also charged with research and evaluation. The ones that collect the information and also decide who gets to see it. The existence of a dominant leader is presupposed... What, it stopped? You pushing the right button?
Yeah. Let me try to fix that.
Yeah. Just push escape and start again. I can keep reading. Go ahead. All right. It's a pretty ancient computer. I got the wrong... Friday, of course, I went, and they were supposed to reserve the good computer for me, and I got the lousy one. Okay. I believe that most of the symptoms of groupthink can be observed as well. I am sure that the political, economic, and missionary successes in the late 20th century have left our leaders with a sense of confidence. I view the church office building as a tangible symbol of invulnerability. The work of the brethren is building the kingdom of God so that they almost certainly view themselves as moral and probably morally superior. Michael Quinn's work gives us some insights into Quorum of the Twelve decision-making. If anything, there is even more service conformity than ever among general authorities, even as those tapped for service are increasingly diverse. Self-censorship is difficult to diagnose. However, I feel the assignment given to Elder Oaks to speak to intellectuals and alternate voices was astute. Given his academic background, he might otherwise be the member of the 12 to be least likely to self-censure. Did you get that point? He was my stake. He was involved in my. He was in my stake presidency. He was my president at BYU, and I just thought, boy, you know, we got a true intellectual in the 12. And the next time I saw him, he came to my ward to give a fireside and basically said, no thinking. Yeah, he was on the dialogue board. But anyway, I still believe that assignment was astute because I think it avoided some potential problems. The peer pressure for conformity must be enormous. The rise to the highest levels in the church is a long one. Years and years of screening takes place. Individual core members use similar voice inflections, dress alike, and even sit and enter and exit rooms in prescribed order. You've heard of that, right? I have heard that this ordering applies to the leaders' wives as well. I mean, this is the quorum of the 12. I don't know if they order the 70s. But hard to keep track of that many positions at the dinner table. If George P. Lee's statements are accurate, speaking and other assignments are bestowed upon conformist tendencies. It's very possible that most general authorities believe their immortal souls are at risk if they oppose ideas of the Lord's anointed. Again, I think that goes back to perhaps second anointing and what that means for the rest of their lives. Stereotyping takes place in many conferences and other talks and articles. Rationalization is apparent in virtually any general conference. Unsettling information or opposition is dismissed as the devil's influence. Finally, I can only imagine how effective the church bureaucracy and individual core members are at performing the mind-guarding role for the general authorities. But did a poor decision take place? I think if you do function F1, you can... All right. All right, but did a poor decision take place? After all, the church seems stronger than ever, with a better public image than ever since the purge. Still, I believe it was a mistake, given my relatively benign experience. I actually got called in, and I liked the stake a lot better after I talked with them for a while than going in. And there were very few of us, I think, that had positive experiences. But it is hard to understand why a lesson wasn't learned through the Sonia Johnson episode. When visible individuals are disciplined for ideas and opinions, bad press results. Many valuable, committed members and their friends... Oh, good. And families may have been lost to the church, or at least become less committed. BYU's accreditation may even be threatened. Certainly, I've been embarrassed by the coverage in the academic press. That filters back to even me. Many of the best and brightest are leaving or becoming less active in the wards and stakes. These may just be just the people we need to avoid poor decisions in the future. On the other hand, perhaps this purging is similar to pruning in preparation for future growth. In any case, moral and ethical principles were breached, due process was violated, and these things were done by basically good, kind people. Were the decisions to have the church participate in the anti-ERA and pro-Prop 22 campaigns bad ones? I believe they were. I've already enumerated some of the potential problems with Prop 22 participation. I strongly believe the church leaders and other members knowingly broke the law during the anti-ERA campaign. I know for a fact that at least some members were asked to lie from the pulpit in Illinois. And I don't think the church has fully recovered from the anti-woman image it gained during the campaign against the ERA. I also believe that active participation in political issues, rather than public pronouncements, principle is a mistake for any religious organization. For one, it is inevitable that a church as large and diverse as the Mormon Church will end up with members on opposite sides of many issues. Just as having members fighting both for and against the Allies in World War II must have posed great difficulties for the church over a half century ago, an increasingly diverse and geographically spread modern church could easily find itself mired in a no-win situation. Imagine taking a stand on the fate of alien, or gun control in the U.S., or divorce in Ireland, or any number of issues in sub-Saharan Africa. Tax-exempt status in the U.S. could be threatened. Resources are diverted from other tasks and causes. Participation can easily become an inappropriate loyalty test for both members and leaders at many levels. Finally, worship, learning, fellowship, etc. can suffer as time and effort is consumed by ballot-specific political activity. Five? Cool. I don't think I have that much left to read. Good. My purpose in this paper is to offer a perspective on group decision-making, which may be unfamiliar to many church members. The message of groupthink is not that groupthink leads to bad decisions. Groups don't need groupthink to make bad decisions. Groupthink can cause them to make bad decisions that individual group members know are bad and silently disagree with. And that's the tragedy. This is really silly. I shouldn't have done this. I indulge myself. But I have a pet list of other decisions which may have been influenced by this phenomenon. They include the denial of priesthood to blacks, changing rules on women praying and speaking in church, changes in mission length, and, you know, back and forth. The inclusion, exclusion of hymns in the new hymnal, church architecture, or lack thereof, the preservation, non-preservation of landmarks, the construction of the supernacle, the Albert Peck told me that. I didn't know what it was. The lack of emeritus status for apostles, the move to the consolidated meeting schedule, the ongoing decisions to stick with the schedule, the standardization of educational materials and buildings, the change in ward budget procedures, decorations and activities of the typical ward party, taking it to the local level, many decisions made in church courts, etc. It can and does influence decision-making at all levels in the church. So what can we do at the local and general levels to avoid groupthink? I have several suggestions based on Moorhead's ideas. First of all, we could do a better job promoting open inquiry. We could start with our lesson manuals. Perhaps more importantly, we could attempt to revive a culture of decision-making which values debate. We could also make greater use of subgroups to study issues and make recommendations. An intriguing possibility would be to set up parallel Relief Society and priesthood subcommittees at every level of decision-making. Another suggestion would perhaps be the most difficult to implement. We could attempt to use more non-directive leadership techniques and debunk the myth of hierarchy and fallibility. It would be difficult primarily because of the predominant view of hierarchical inspiration. But it is clear Joseph was a charismatic rather than directive leader who relied, people would disagree with me, I know, but who relied heavily, perhaps too heavily, on the advice of others. Maybe we could reverse the trend started by Brigham Young and get back to our earliest roots. It is to the general leadership's credit that they have apparently been more open to the advice of outside experts of late. But I get the impression that leaders are mainly open to information from Orthodox members. From the local ward to headquarters in Salt Lake City, we could benefit from the ideas and advice of less Orthodox members and community members alike. BYU is a great resource of friendly advice, which with a little prodding would probably also be frank. Even the faculty of the University of Utah might be able to provide useful ideas once in a while. I went to both places, so. We have many highly valued professional consultants, including Glenn Cornett, who would likely offer free advice. I believe that the Special Affairs Committee is not a sufficient conduit to outside expert opinion. Perhaps general leadership councils could be served by larger, more independent support staffs on the congressional model. The final suggestion is to hold second chance meetings to consider important decisions. This device may seem foreign and uncomfortable. Unless inspiration is received, shouldn't the thinking and debate be over? Well, Section 9 of the Doctrine and Covenants points out that even inspiration requires substantial effort. Perhaps each of these devices could be viewed as ways to exert the type of effort the Lord requires before inspiration will flow. Would these procedural and cultural changes make a difference in the quality of decisions? I believe they would. More caution would be taken before political campaigns are entered into. I believe the purge wouldn't have taken place. I know events like Mountain Meadows would have been avoided. Thank you. Oh, that's right. We need a little switch. Oh, you go ahead.
You know, I was at the University of Chicago grad school business with Dylan Oakes. We would talk.
University of
Chicago.
When he was in law school. Okay.
Anyway, we had very free-ranging discussions with him and Clay Pope and the like. A lot of guys like that.
Clay Pope, an economics professor. I have a degree in economics from BYU.
And Oakes and all of us were saying, this is how we change BYU. Get rid of Ernie Wilkinson and get rid of this group think, basically, and allow us the freedom of thought and how we change the church. And Don Oakes was really into all this and all this stuff. You're saying he changed, or he's modified his behavior.
Well, I think so. Well, again, I don't want to take Glenn's time here, but I believe there is a huge pressure on these individuals. And I don't have any inside information, but I firmly believe that the members of Quorum of 12 believe that if they ever contradicted the prophet or publicly spoke out against any position, that their eternal souls would be damned. I believe that's the case. And so I think that's a lot of pressure. But again, what?
I used to know some of them.
Publicly?
No, privately. In fact, that's the only way I could know them. It was in the time when the church was much smaller. No, their feeling was a strong feeling of loyalty to the organization. They used to do private lobbying. You let things sing. You know, you do private information, private lobbying on a
not in a public meeting basis. You can talk to your buddy over there who's part of the Forum of the 12 and you say, do you really think this is acceptable? So you could try to get a consensus before you go to a meeting, because the meeting has to be unanimous to make a choice. And so you do a little inside stuff. Now, those guys tried. They kept their, many times, they kept their opinions themselves. I was very young. I can't claim that I really understood all the workings of content, but I did. But they did give enough information in what they said so that it was clear that they did all of these things. They did this private lobbying, and they did try to do certain things in order to get certain points of view to the top. And the most obvious example of that was in for Houston versus, I should be excited.
Well, you haven't heard me speak. You might change your mind.
Can I ask all the questions till after? No, I got 10
minutes. Right. Very well. I'll endeavor to be brief, but if I speak too fast, then you have trouble understanding me. So we'll work for that. I'll go over things that basically in the order John Tarjan did. Talk about groupthink, anticipate conditions, symptoms, and results, and then what we should do. Actually, I'll be a bit more tentative, perhaps. John Tarjan has favored us with a reasonable explanation of groupthink and a lucid litany of examples. In the earlier portion of his remarks, the examples are largely from the Nazis and the Republicans, two groups which many here may think to be morally equivalent. That by itself would make for an interesting discussion, but let's defer that opportunity. There is a party in my room, number 1777, after the close of the official proceedings. So feel free to engage in that then. In the meantime, I propose that many of the aspects of groupthink discussed by John are part and parcel of organizations that rely upon revealed truth. By revealed truth, I mean positions of certainty that derive at least some of their validation neither from empirical observation nor rigorous analysis and synthesis, but rather from a purported infallible source accessible only to either a single individual or a restricted set of individuals. Most, if not all, religions, by their nature, rely upon revealed truth. One of the best Snyder marks I heard about this was Neil Chandler. A lot of you know him. In one of his stories, he uses the phrase revealed free market capitalism. Okay. This ostensibly, as though most if not all religions by their nature rely upon revealed truth, this ostensibly is even true of the Unitarian Church, and is particularly the case for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Our basic, yea, even canonical, reliance upon modern scripture and contemporaneous revelation make us arguably more revealed than most. Of course, the word revelation itself comes from the same root as the word reveal. The fact that we are more revealed than most potentiates the likelihood of what John terms to be groupthink, but which many ordinary Mormons might term to be valid religious experience. This makes experience as critically thinking Mormons all the more deliciously complex, or at least painfully fraught with apparent dilemmas. Due to time limitations, I will restrict my remarks to only a portion of the groupthink aspects addressed by John. If I put this up, can you people still see the screen, or do I need to put this down? You okay over here? Okay. Fair enough. First, the group cohesiveness is a tendency of human communities, at least the ones that have survived. This cohesiveness tends to be potentiated by explicit, apparently willful adoption of a detailed code of beliefs and actions that are ostensibly prerequisite to membership in most religious communities, and again, ours in particular. Insulation and parochialism themselves tend to follow from preferential weighting of internal sources, especially those sources to which are attributed to them absolute moral ascendance. Does this sound familiar? When sustaining church years is requisite to full participation in our community, if you want to be a card-carrying Mormon, as in one who carries a temple recommend, when that sustaining is requisite to full participation, that naturally makes the leaders dominant. Okay, let's go through just a couple of symptoms of groupthink here. The illusion of invulnerability. End-state invulnerability is one of the principal tenets of most religions, perhaps summed up succinctly in the following: believe and behave well now, and it will all get better. The illusion of morality. Again, moral ascendance is presupposed in the structure of many religions, particularly ours. If this is only a mild illusion at selected times, membership in our church could conceivably remain a viable proposition. If the officially purported moral status of our church is largely illusion, then grounds for participation might become social at best. For many who find the officially purported moral status of our church to be quite spurious, there arguably are more socially fulfilling organizations. Attempting to close the loop here, hopefully a positive moral position is more than an illusion for our church. Otherwise, we arguably have much better places to be. As LeGrand Richards once said, if you can find a better church, join it. Looking at decision processes themselves, religion tends to limit its search to canonically sanctioned sources, principally being revealed scripture and personal revelation. This can understandably lead to rejection of those who disagree with canonical sources, such as church leaders. So let's look at some results of groupthink. So what happens when groupthink ostensibly exists in a religious environment? The careless, cynical response could be business as usual. On the other hand, a response after careful, fair, balanced, and reasoned judgment might be business as usual. Speaking as a scientist, I believe that advances in science have demanded greater flexibility in people that are religious, critical, and aware. Our church, as a centralized institution, on the other hand, has arguably been less tolerant of flexibility. The church the church as an experience for individuals and certain groups, however, has been more flexible. Many of those who have not found a forum for greater flexibility, not in the church at large, but in smaller groups, many of those who have not found a forum for greater flexibility have instead left the church. The Sunstone and Dialogue arguably have helped provide fora, places that helping these people, and in many cases, I think, allows people to remain comfortably active believing Mormons. Clearly, the ostensibly increased centralization and correlation of LDS church power and decisions has led to disappointment among certain church members. I would suggest that this resultantly dissatisfied group, however, composed a small minority of church membership. One might, in fact, refer to this group as a vanishingly small minority, as in they are vanishing from our chapels. Indeed, many of the members that have made my church experience most meaningful have left the church. A few years ago, one of my friends, who happens to be in attendance at the symposium today, told me that I would soon be the sole remaining active member of the church with an IQ over 100. I think he's wrong. How many of you here actually go to church? Maybe I shouldn't do that, but a few of you at least. Okay. And I think that the threshold IQ to participate in Sunstone is probably at least one standard deviation unit above the norm, or 115. So I think he's wrong. Okay. So, overall, however, I have not detected a decreased morale on church members at large over the past 20 years. Most have been either oblivious or apathetic as to the Dialogue and Sunstone community. Arguably, the church has taken a utilitarian stance and gotten away with it by many measures of accomplishment. They have quite possibly, with explicit intention, alienated or marginalized a small group of members in order to retain and attract a larger group of members. Maybe the parable would be alienate the one to save the 99. I mean, the sales and marketing equation, at least, is reasonably favorable. If the principal measure of success for the church is the growth of its active membership, or at least the shoring up of losses from the body of its membership, the church has arguably been successful in its endeavors and actually enhanced global net morale in relation to where it would have been otherwise. Let me give a brief view on Proposition 22 in groupthink. Shortly before the vote, National Public Radio ran a piece on Proposition 22 about an impressively broad group of religious leaders coming out against the measure. Right at the end of the segment, the reporter mentioned that Mormon and Catholic churches, however, supported Proposition 22, which just made my whole day a cheerful one. It struck me that those two religions would be significantly distant from each other in just about any multidimensional state space mapping of Christian institutions. Take, for example, the Neoplatonism, the disavowal of the material, the physical as evil and perverse and corrupt, reflected in many Catholic doctrines, versus the Joyce materialism of DNC Section 131, all spirit is matter, and our belief the system in general, which says that, you know, the physical body is something very important. We need to come here to pick one up because we need it in stage four down the road. Okay. Where we do have significant similarity, also think about their claim of the Catholic Church's claim of enduring authority as opposed to our fundamental belief that the Catholic Church itself was the end product of a major apostasy. Where we do have significant similarity and distinction from most other Christian churches with over 1 million members is a purported living, active, uniquely privileged connection to revealed truth. A pope for the Catholic Church, a prophet or body of general authorities, to take your pick, for the LDS community. Okay. What should we do? Hierarchy will continue to be integral to the structure of many religions, ours in particular. This is a prediction, but I feel fairly comfortable with that one. I anticipate that the hierarchical nature of our church will persist for quite some time, and that that will result in continuing dismissal of many external sources as either irrelevant or dangerous. I also, in this context, do not anticipate an explosion of second-chance meetings in the near future. Gee, did we make that decision right? Let's mull that, especially publicly, right? Probably not going to happen. Remember Levi Peterson's analogy from yesterday evening? He likened intellectual dissenters to puppy dogs barking at trains. He mentioned, however, that puppy dogs were sufficiently intelligent to stay off the tracks when the trains were in proximity. While there are ostensibly some ways to engage our leaders in a positive, meaningful fashion, I would stress that we are possibly well advised to spend a good deal of time off the proverbial tracks. This isn't a vote for cowardice, but rather one for maintaining the appropriate level of meaningful interchange. There is an issue of pearls before swine, but that is probably not a good thing to say in this case. There's an issue of Lord's anointing and all that. But think in roughly those terms, but not exactly those terms. If we as individual thinkers persist in looking for essential affirmation in dialogue with those who have other issues and groups with which they would rather engage, I think we are going to be disappointed. I tend instead to advocate continuing association with a larger community, in other words, remaining active in church on the one hand, but reserving some of the more sensitive discussions for smaller, more intimate discussions. I would say that this doesn't apply only to religious views, it applies to political views, what have you. You don't casually stroll through the office and espouse your political views. That is probably counterproductive to the overall community of what you're trying to get done. Likewise, at church, most people, even in my ward in Palo Alto, second ward, would not appreciate a lot of my ideas. So I don't give them the blissful privilege of knowing all of my private thoughts. What I do is engage them at a level that I think appropriate for the occasion and for the audience. Okay, enough pontification. Let's take some more questions. Go ahead. John, why don't you come up here? I gather these are both of us.
Yeah, actually, before I do, just 15 seconds. Let me iterate. The comments were good, and I think that, clearly a lot of the suggestions I have are a little off the wall. Not likely to happen. But
I didn't say that.
No.
A bit challenging.
Yeah, okay. But the one thing is, if the Mormon Church or any other group decided to buy Microsoft stock and it went down precipitously next week, I don't have a problem with that. You don't need groupthink to do that. But if they decided to do something like, disfellowship all women who were working outside home and have small children, or, whatever, we decided to issue a product that we knew was unsafe, like the brakes on the, there's a brake problem where they knew they were going to kill people and still certified a brake, that's what's a problem. When people know that a decision is bad, immoral, wrong, and censor themselves, and a group comes to a decision that individuals would not come to individually. I agree. To me, the problem with groupthink is a problem when people know it's wrong and it still goes forward. But anyway, go ahead. Any questions? Do you want to call on them? Or
we have 5 minutes. We're already 5 minutes over.
Yeah, we started late, though.
Make them good.
Well, who do I... my father-in-law, I'm staying at his house tonight, so I got to call him.
Got to do that.
I have a comment about two ways that might be interesting, maybe three. I worked in the church office building one time, and there are a lot of people who would write into the general authorities, and they would have funny ideas, but they would make them okay. The other was, I was on the Church Data Processing Committee a long time ago. There was a committee was set up, and they said to us, pray and think about anything you want. Be completely wild. Should we even have temples? Anything. And one of the questions was, you know, can you just put lay hands on the people and do the temple work all at one time? And the reason for having temples was old people needed something to do. Third, I had a friend by the name of Rick.
Well, can't they be serve missions in Hawaii or something too?
One of my best friends was named Rex Faust in graduate school. We had a lot of discussion among various people about various things, such as the Negro question.
Mm-hmm.
Two approaches. I was teaching at an elders' quorum at the time. I mean, later on, and put them and brought in somebody with gloves on, so forth, and had them speak, and respond to questions. They did a wonderful job. The bishop was sort of wondering if he should be baptized with children. On the other hand, Rex Faust and his brother, James Faust, were both missionaries to Brazil. They realized the time had come for inspiration, and James Faust, about the time that the Negro question was, became an apostle. So there's two ways of going about it. One at the top, one at the bottom.
Okay, thank you. Somebody over here, with either hand, whoever wants to be more assertive.
Fair enough. Well,
I'm having a hard time deciding how you balance that. I don't think there's a way you can.
No, that's a good question. I had a relevant decision I made about a year and a half ago when I was asked to be on the editorial board for Dialogue. And I had this strategy sort of top down. So many of my favorite people are leaving the church that it's like, well, if I like behave myself, at least pretend to, and actually get in authority positions, my friends are less likely to leave the church. Becky and Neil Chandler were good friends, and they were doing very interesting work, and I thought they had a wonderful vision for the journal, so I decided to do it. You know, and I haven't gotten in trouble for that. You know, maybe it's had me not called a couple things, but I just sat down with my bishop, looking point blank during the last temple recommend interview, and, you know, are you affiliated with any communist groups, what have you? And I said, well, I'm in the Dialogue Journal. And he was quite fine with that. He goes, yeah, you should read that local journal, or maybe, I don't know, I haven't seen it for a while. So I think that you're allowed some swath, and I think it's a function of your local leaders. Sounds like your local leaders are not quintessentially sympathetic. Okay.
Let me just add, that reminds me of one story. I had a BYU professor whose father was in a Utah, I guess a rural ward, and President Clark came and was speaking against Social Security. And it was in sacrament meeting, and all of a sudden he got up in the back of the congregation and said, "No, Heber, you're wrong." Well, he was up at the pulpit, and I don't think we'd see that much today.
One more question.
You want to pick him here?
I don't.
Okay, there you go. Yeah. Yes.
My question is to both of you, really. It's just, I think that the challenges that I've personally been having with Proposition 22, this whole Boy Scouts thing now, it's just a lot of it. I mean, I'm a convert to the church, and I consider myself active right now. It's why. Have a hard time staying in the church, I think. and I wonder what keeps you in the church.
That's a great question. Do you still go? Should I ask you that in front of you?
I don't know if I can respond to that, but let me just tell you that, again, a lot of the reasons I've done the papers that I've done is hopefully to offer an organizational perspective where people say, gee, how could this happen in a church that's supposed to be good and wonderful and beneficial? Well, things like this happen in all organizations. And I think that we have to be realistic, but I think we can learn from other organizations as well. What keeps me going? Well, what keeps anybody going? You know, I think we all have the church on our own terms. And, you know, for me, it's fellowship. And when I don't feel the fellowship, I don't go. But, you know, that's a personal thing. We need to get into it. You can address that.
Yeah. I personally came from a ward recently where I didn't feel a lot of fellowship, but I went anyway because I felt somewhere, intuitively, it was good for me. I'm now in a ward where I'm fairly comfortable. But what keeps me really going is a basis, a substrate of spiritual experiences which I've had in life, which I have chosen not to pass off as neurological epiphenomena. You know, I have had, I'd say, some significant positive experiences in the church. I have the same problems just about everyone here has in one flavor or another, but I think there is a baby with the bathwater issue here, and I think a lot of us here feel the same way. You know, I could, you know, forget the leaders of the church, I could intellectualize myself out of any sort of religious frame of mind in a matter of seconds if I wanted to. I have, however, had enough of these spiritual experiences that have kept me in. The closest I came to leaving the church was when I was 10 years old. It was over Blacks in the Priesthood. I had been forced against my will to go to a private school, which ended up being a great experience for me. It was in the middle of Detroit. It was intensely integrated. It looked like they had, okay, Caucasian, because it was about half and half. It was a great experience for me. And I came out of there and went into sixth grade and 10 years old, and I'm sitting there thinking, how can we not give the priesthood to Blacks? And I was ready to leave. And I was calling other churches, you know, because most other churches didn't have this particular issue, right? They had plenty of others I would have found out had I joined one of them, but didn't have this particular issue. And I just felt inside that I was doing the wrong thing. And I went on that, and I'm very glad I did. My life has more existential dilemmas than it would were I no longer a practicing religious person, but my life is also more meaningful, and I think overall better.
Yeah, I'm a professor. I'm just going to give one more word. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. And I'm not, so I'll shut up.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say that every organization we belong to, we give up something. You know, organizations are wonderful. They marshal resources, and they give us strength, and all sorts of great things in fellowship and meet our needs. But we always give up something. And I think you just have to have the attitude that this is my church. Just like nobody has to tell you what God is thinking or what his existence or her existence is like. You can have your own feelings, your own belief, your own testimony. Gordon Hinckley is the president and the prophet. But it's no more his church than it is mine. And I think that's what keeps a lot of us going, if we can have that attitude. Anyway, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.